We get the bills. Back on the air with an ear to the streets. Welcome back to Owen's Variety Hour. Finally back in the studio, and we're feeling great, if I'm going to be honest. You know, recording from home, it was pretty fun, but I just don't think it's the same. I like being here. It's pretty comfy. I like doing this live. It may just be more of a pleasant experience here for me personally. And in other relevant Variety Hour news, next week we might actually change it up a bit. I might have a guest with me, a good friend of mine, and classical Hollywood cinema enthusiast Kyle Perez might join me to talk about movies and whatnot. I'll end up just sort of adjusting the show to include some sort of an interview portion. The review will be based on something that we both watched and it'll be more of a discussion. Most likely will be something from his wheelhouse, so he can sort of like school me on it, give me all the facts and whatnot. Because, I don't know, it'd be no fun for anyone involved for me just to come on and yell about my stuff like I usually do to someone who's barely interested. So I'm looking forward to that. It will be a good opportunity to switch up the whole dynamic of the show, I think. And last week, as I said, I pre-recorded the show because I was at a Julia Holter concert at the Great Hall in Toronto, which is honestly one of the best venues I've ever been to. It's probably the best venue in Toronto. I've seen a few great shows there before, notably Mount Erie. He comes to mind because the venue just has a way, because of sort of how it's laid out, of creating a really intimate atmosphere, which makes for a great show. And if anyone has heard Julia Holter's most recent album, Aviary, which ended up being one of my favorite albums of last year, it's this sort of lush, beautiful, yet sparse album that occasionally lends itself more to classical music than pop or art pop or anything. And just that type of music in this intimate venue was a perfect pairing. Julia Holter broke out more in the indie scene from the album before Aviary, Have You My Wilderness, which is more of a traditional Baroque pop album. And I think she did a great job at merging these two styles together because she was using the same band for the songs from both albums. So it felt more like she was merging the styles together, which broke down the barriers that I think some people felt and the differences between these two albums. But honestly, the performances were just wonderful throughout the whole show. There's improvisations throughout, songs being stretched out as the band was following Julia's hand cues like a composer at the front of the stage. One of the more memorable things that I'll remember about the show is just Julia's personality. I hadn't really seen her talk much or anything before, but she was just really funny, really goofy. She kept on complimenting the audience for being great listeners in this fun, playful way. And she was just playing with different modes on her keyboards at the time, making like little deadpan jokes. It was just lighthearted and cute. But then when she got back into the songs, this whole goofy side was gone. It was serious. It was perfect. And then she played for nearly like 2 hours, and it felt really just like conclusive, that it was just a full show. And I didn't really expect an encore or anything, because I appreciate it when people don't really feel the need to do the encore, that the show is enough. But then she came back and she did a mashup of her cover of Barbara Lewis's Hello Stranger with her song Betsy on the Roof, while stretching both songs out and merging them together, doing some improv vocals. She was singing or talking about the beautiful chandelier in the venue that she had been looking at for the whole night. And it was just really funny and a sweet moment to end the night. So that's sort of an update of what I've been to. And now we're going to go to a little bit of a break. This is Julia Holter with I Shall Love. What a beautiful song. I believe she closed the show with that song. Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I think she might have opened it with I Shall Love One. Maybe. I don't know. I don't quite remember. I was just sort of like there, present in the moments, rather than just like thinking about every little detail that happened. Well, for the new discovery section this week, I wanted to firstly talk about the new Gaspar Noé film, Climax. Gaspar Noé is mostly known for the 2009 film Enter the Void, which sort of explores the psychedelic trip of that comes right after death under the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it's filmed partially in a POV shot, which goes through these many like psychedelic effects as we follow him after death, with all the sex and drugs and things that come with it as he explores his life and the lives around him. The film has gathered a lot of acclaim for its innovative style, as well as its shocking and edgy subject matter, something that Gaspar Noé has been known for throughout his career, and this is no exception with his newest work, Climax. Climax shows the night of a French dance troupe whose sangria gets unexpectedly spiked with LSD. So yeah, it's pretty wild right from the start. And the film has this driving pace from start to finish as sort of their trip intensifies and changes, which really just like gets the blood rushing through your veins, and it just doesn't stop throughout the whole movie. It's constantly visually fascinating, it's shocking, it's exhilarating, and there's this like pulsing techno and electronic music throughout it, and everyone's dancing, but like the whole thing is so well choreographed. Considering that the majority of the shots are quite long, with the camera sort of weaving through different people, following different people throughout the same shot, consecutively one after the other, and as it's weaving through people and everyone's dancing past the camera, and it's just everything's very well put together and very well rehearsed. And this was an absolutely unique experience, I think, at the theater, simply by the reactions to the audience right after it ended. Because just like, it's a pretty abrupt ending, and then everyone's just sort of like looking at each other because we all just experienced the same crazy thing. And I gotta say that if you do have the opportunity to see this in theaters and you think you are up for it, I'd highly recommend it. The next thing I want to talk about are the new Carly Rae Jepsen singles. We just got two brand new songs from one of the dear queens of pop music. Neither one is too far outside the Carly Rae norm, but they're both absolute bops. She just is giving us pretty much exactly what we want from her. It's not getting old yet, but considering that the song and the sound is sort of updated from the sort of emotion era, it sounds fresh for sure, so I don't think anyone's going to be too upset with it or anything. The first song is Now That I Found You, which is pretty upbeat. It's really happy, danceable, it's like a good party track. The instrumental is really good. I really like the synth parts during the verses. And for the songwriting, the bridge particularly is really great, and then the chorus is just really catchy, Carly per usual. But I feel like this song, more than other Carly Rae Jepsen songs, is sort of giving her more opportunity to explore the upper side of her vocal range, which makes it sort of a standout for her. But it's just a great pop song for sure. The next song is No Drug Like Me, which is sort of a more of a downbeat song. It has the traditional type of sort of a synth pop production, but it works really well with her songwriting, as it always has. But in particular, the layer of the synthesizers throughout the whole song just keeps it really interesting. And I actually really happen to like both of these songs, as I've made it quite clear. But they're both released together in the same sort of double single. And I think there's a really good show of what Carly is capable of. She has songwriting chops that are variable, and she has the ability to write both these songs and really own them, perform them really well. And I'm really looking forward to the upcoming album from her. Both these albums are better than her most recent single, Party for One. So hopefully the rest of them will be more on this level than the other song, even though it is still pretty great, because Carly Rae Jepsen is just pretty great. This is that second song, Carly Rae Jepsen, No Drug Like Me. For my review section this week, I wanted to talk about Gus Van Sant's Death Trilogy. Gus Van Sant is an American filmmaker who's mostly known for some very popular films, such as the queer cinema landmark My Own Private Idaho from 1991, starring Keanu Reeves and River Phoenix, and the classic Good Will Hunting with Robin Williams and Matt Damon from 1997. And this is just sort of to note the background of this filmmaker, what I knew Gus Van Sant for before this trilogy, and the world did too, I guess. And after this, in 2002, Van Sant began his ambitious and polarizing Death Trilogy. The main unifier in this trilogy is that the three films are based on real-life deaths, albeit fictionalized in the movies, sort of separating from any accusations surrounding faithful representations and whatnot. And beyond this, there are some very clear stylistic similarities that go across the three movies. In particular, all three films fall under the slow cinema genre, outside of what Gus Van Sant was making before, or really what most or any people in Hollywood are making. Slow cinema is known for its very long shot lengths and usually minimal or slow progressing narratives. And this is fun considering that some of the shots in like Jerry, for instance, go on for approximately 10 minutes. And the average shot length in Hollywood is around 5 seconds. The Death Trilogy incorporates these elements into the films throughout the films, which sparked some outrage from audiences, labeling Gus in the movies as pretentious, self-indulgent even, but let's just dive into it. As I just mentioned, the first film is called Jerry, which follows around two men named Jerry as they get lost in the desert looking for something, as they refer to it as The Thing. The Jerrys are played by Matt Damon and Casey Affleck, having both been in some of Gus Van Sant's movies before. But that's about it for the plot of the movie. Note what I said about minimal or slow narratives. We follow them around for a bit until Casey can't go on any further, as they're getting lost in this woods, and Casey can't go any further, and then asks Matt Damon to murder him, and he does. And then Matt Damon gets out and finds a car, and then presumably makes it to safety, but having to live with the death of his friend. That is the whole movie. There's not really many other plot points throughout. So we're just following them as they continuously get lost, they misread maps, they have some conversations. And what you'd sort of think or expect from some road movie or drama like this would be some really profound, intimate conversations. But they really just end up talking about, like, Age of Empires or Wheel of Fortune, just random everyday things, things you would never expect to hear in a movie. And it's sort of trying to resemble what real friends would talk about on a hike. Maybe not if they were lost and fearing their lives, but just like a normal hike. And this is sort of the element that keeps this movie goofy and funny. They keep using their names as verbs for messing up, like they Jerry'd it. And it's just sort of played off like an inside joke that they developed over their friendship, a friendship that we don't really know much context about or any history or anything. This whole movie is sort of escalated and made super fascinating by this beautiful and incredible cinematography from Harry Savides, I think you pronounce it, who luckily shot the whole trilogy. In a film class, we read and discussed some of André Bazin's thoughts about The Long Take, which really come to mind when I think of Jerry in particular, as he sort of talks about when the camera is let to roll longer than an intended action shot, you sort of begin to see life in a more realistic sense coming out. As when not everything is planned and in short focus, the shot isn't fabricated. You're shooting actual people walking. That is effectively real life, that sort of thing. And just like, that's sort of the appeal of this film. The majority of the film is silent, without any dialogue. There's only some music from the incredible composer Arvo Pärt, and it's particularly beautiful and fitting for the movie. But besides just this elusive atmosphere, the film just does have a lot of charm as well. As I mentioned before, some of the jokes they have between them. And Damon and Affleck just do have a lot of natural chemistry. I think a lot of the lines were improvised, as they're both credited as writers along with Gus Van Sant. But there are some hilarious scenes when Casey's Jerry gets stuck on top of a tall rock for somehow and can't get down. So to help Matt Damon's Jerry makes a sand mattress for him to jump onto. So this is just a naturally silly situation, but it's also just so long and it keeps going, which is to some like me adding an extra layer of comedy to it. To others is just spoiling the joke. It's also just impressive how Casey then does jump from the rock onto the sand mattress, which just seems like a dangerous stunt altogether. I didn't expect to see that. But as much as the movie does just sound stupid or silly, it's really affecting. Watching these long shots of them just walking through the desert makes you feel what they're going through in a way that no other like desertion or man versus nature could really do, because they aren't really saying as much as how exhausted we are. We aren't understanding their emotions through that, but we can just feel it just by watching the journey out in long time. If you're watching two guys walk for 10 minutes in the blaring heat, you can tell what it would feel like, and you can sort of empathize with it. This film is really critiqued and mocked all the time, mainly because it's boring, it's meaningless, nothing happens. But that's all in the synopsis. Who cares about that? That's a pretty light criticism. If you watch this movie and you really pay attention to it, it's really easy to find something that most movies won't give you, won't try to give you even. The next movie in the trilogy is Elephant from 2003. And this is Gus Van Sant's interpretation or recreation of the Columbine Massacre. And this, I'd have to say, is the most human or genuine movie of the trilogy, I think. Or at least it has the most sort of real world, maybe like philosophical application. Because most of this movie is just simply a normal day at a high school. We get glimpses of the students' lives. Just like slight glimpses, though. One has a drunk father. One is trying to be a photographer, but most of the characters don't go any deeper than that. And that's because they aren't really characters in the normal sense. They're the types of side characters that people normally complain about for being one-dimensional or boring, but this is sort of more or less the point of it all. I see this film as a protest against the sort of typical disaster-related biopic. Rather than fictionalized stories or big narratives about these characters, these are just surface level, they're just people, they're high school students. Rather than sensationalizing their lives to make this event seem tragic, Van Sant doesn't think that they need this focus to be important, to make their lives traumatic. If anything, this makes it more affecting. These are normal people. These are people that you would see if you just walked into a high school one day. These may be the type of people that were at students at Columbine. And as for the killers, there isn't really a strong sense of a motive or anything that's being told. It's not any sort of a mystery movie or anything that or a deep dive into the psyche of a killer. We see that they're bullied, they're sort of upset, and they're just drawn to violence. Is it the video games they're playing? Gus Van Sant doesn't imply that. They just like violence, and they know that it'll make them famous. The next movie is Last Days from 2005, which is based on the final days before Kurt Cobain's suicide. And so we sort of just see the main character. His name is Blake, but he is obviously just Kurt Cobain. So we see him as just a shadow of a person, pretty much. He doesn't really have many humanly qualities at this point. He barely talks. He just sort of walks around without expressing himself to anybody. We aren't shown anything about the man he used to be, but who he was at that point. This is interesting because we know the character as merely a Kurt Cobain vessel, so Gus doesn't really need to tell us anything. We know the rough history about his rise to fame, and we also know what's going to happen. This movie is mainly Blake's dead time, sort of resembling other slow cinema movies like Chantal Ackerman and John Dielman, which I know had a big influence on Gus Van Sant. And this is just because it's sort of showing Blake with nothing to do. He doesn't want to do anything. And this sort of moments of dead time have more implications on his character. They say more than any real internal monologue or plot points could do. And I always think it's funny when you know some things about a movie way before you watched it and when you end up watching it, it's a completely different movie than what you had once thought it was. Because I'd heard this movie before as just some bad Kurt Cobain biopic. But I didn't really understand the critiques of it. And I definitely didn't know they were about the experimentation and the pacing of the movie. I didn't think that would be the protests against this Kurt Cobain biopic. But again, there's something that separates this movie from the other movies. And I think it would have to be that there are honestly some really moving scenes from this that could stand alone, which you couldn't really say about Jerry or Elephant for the most part. There's this one incredible scene particularly where Blake is just playing music at his house after everyone just left. We see him from the outside of the house through these big windows as the camera zooms out, and he's sort of looping instruments, he's playing everything at the same time together. And the music comes off as quite experimental and cathartic. And not that I've heard many of Kurt Cobain's actual demos from this period, but from some of his other experimentations that I've heard, I wouldn't be surprised if this is what they sounded like. But this is really the only time in the movie up to this point that we see Blake as something resembling function. And as much as it's a cliche to say that this is the only way he can function, considering how late in the movie this was, it just hits you really hard seeing him like this. Another scene is when Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth makes an appearance, and she's talking to Blake about his daughter, and she asks if he apologizes to her for being a rock and roll cliche. And he says yes, or he just nods. And he knows that he doesn't see his daughter anymore. He goes up and visits her room after. It's really sad. But it's just Blake knows that all he is at this point is a cliche. A cliche to us, the audience, that Kurt Cobain effectively created. Or at least this rock and roll, drug-obsessed, falling from fame cliche that Kurt Cobain created or resurrected. And it's just sort of that sad and haunting reality that this character lives with that we're being shown. So those are the three movies. And before I get really into what ties them together, there's also these intertextual references that are pretty funny that link them, or at least place them all in the same universe. Particularly, I think both movies, other movies, link to Jerry. In Elephant, we see one of the killers playing a video game based on Jerry, where you're shooting down all the different Jerrys, and it's obviously comedic effect. And in Last Days, Harmony Korine makes a little cameo and makes a reference to playing Dungeons and Dragons with a guy named Jerry, who was the best dungeon master he'd ever played with. And it's not as explicitly a reference as Elephant, but it sort of shows how they all play in the same world, or at least to some effect. Because Elephant may exist in our world where the movie Jerry was created. It's all complicated, and I don't really want to get too far into it, but it's funny. So one of the things that I thought was interesting, thinking about all these movies, is just about how the mundane and uneventfulness that happens in all three, where this comes from. In Jerry, the two Jerrys are both seeking their lives in reality, the lives that they left when they went into the desert and now that they're lost from. It's mundane because we follow them as they're wandering around, directionless, trying to get to somewhere, trying to get back. In Elephant, we see these same mundane sort of activities. We see people walking around because they don't know they're part of a movie. They don't think they're part of an event or anything sensational until it inevitably occurs. In Last Days, Blake is sort of escaping his reality. So this comes from his lack of life effectively. He's avoiding the overwhelming pressure of the public eye that he's gotten himself into. And I think the implication of this is pretty affecting to me personally, because it just puts Gus's style. It makes it more apparent as you see all these things together. Gus is showing events unfolding through opposite and contrasting ways of life as characters are seeking different things. They are either with objective, as in Jerry, they're without objective, as in Elephant, or they're actively avoiding objective, as in Last Days. And you can make some big statement and argue that these are really the three options for life that one has. And Gus is interested in exploring these played out, but he's playing them out in this non-sensationalized way. He's seeing people rather than understanding them. And this sort of thing can also be attributed to the deaths in these films and how they relate to the real world events that occurred. In Jerry, the plot comes from a real event in which two friends got lost and one Mercy killed the other by his own suggestion. And this is all that Gus Van Sant wanted to know before making the movie, because he just wanted to be influenced by the event. He didn't want to try to be telling their story. And so it's supposed to reflect the life, reflect the event, rather than recreate or sort of pay homage to it or anything. But what Gus does is he shows by representing and recreating the lives of these people, of these friends, the Columbine students or Kurt Cobain, what is he sort of aiming to do? You could analyze that it is sort of this response to the sensationalized journalism that takes place and creates huge stories and dialogues out of these lives and their tragic deaths. Is he sort of searching for a meaning and underlying narratives in the real people's lives that are lost? A lot of the time, it's pretty unsure what he's trying to do. As in these deaths, they are unexplained. They are more or less unexplored, undramatic. It's not this huge plot point that comes. It's sort of seen as this inevitable thing that the characters fall into. And as much as they're unexplored, they're undramatic, they're very real. That's one thing you could say about these movies, is that everyone involved, all the characters, feel like real people. People that you sort of get to understand through how they're represented by Gus, and then you see them, their loss. This song was actually featured in Last Days. This is Velvet Underground's Venus in Furs. Susie had been a postal worker for the past 5 years. She decided that it was what she wanted after she became friends with her mailman, Todd. Todd had been her mailman ever since she could remember. They didn't speak too much. Conversations with your mailman are limited to once a day, max, pretty much. And some days you don't even have mail, especially in this digital age. Maybe this is what Susie saw in Todd. He represented the old way of life. He also represented things she bought showing up, and that's nice as well. One day, she was waiting for a brand new set of phone chargers or some $3 DVD or whatever she had bought 3 to 5 business days before, when she saw Todd walking up. She noticed that her neighbor's fence was open. She had seen enough cartoons to know exactly what would happen as the dog barked and immediately charged at Todd. Susie knew that she needed to save Todd. Life was on the line. She ran into the kitchen, grabbed a conveniently located pork chop, ran back to the door and threw it as far as she could. The pork chop went right across the street onto a neighbor's lawn, and for some reason, the dog kept coming. Luckily, Todd was surprisingly fast for his appearance, impressively fast even. Susie had the door ready for him and slammed it as soon as he jumped through. And all they could hear was the thump of the dog against the wall. They were worried for the old pup, but it wasn't even 20 seconds until they heard him chewing on the chop from across the road. As soon as Todd caught his breath, he told Susie that this was the first time that he had been in a client's home in maybe 10 years. Susie hadn't noticed how lonely this seemed until much later. Todd spent his whole life giving things to people's homes that he'd never enter. Todd's placement in the whole supply chain value system was being absolutely underappreciated by consumers all over the world. He asked if Susie could get him a glass of water while he recollected from his near-death experience. She got it quickly, 3 ice cubes, 1 slice of lemon. She sat down with them, and for the first time they had a real discussion. They had spoken briefly before, but she never really felt like she knew him. He told her about why he became a postman, some of his stories. Then he told her what he likes about the job, what keeps him around. He told her about the little pieces of joy that he sees in people's eyes when they notice him, knowing that their much-loved and anticipated products have finally arrived. It's such a small and genuine display of emotion, one that only he would ever see. This was the sweetest thing that Susie had ever heard in her whole life. Todd lived his life for these little moments. Someone needed to do the job anyway, and he never asked for much. This came at a very important time in Susie's life. She had just left her previous job a few weeks before. It began to dissatisfy her. She didn't feel like she was making a positive impact anywhere. And once she accepted that, it didn't really feel like she had any reason to stay. Todd told her that if she was interested, she could fill out an application, and with his word behind her, she would definitely get the job. Susie made sure to order something online as soon as Todd left, and by the time he delivered the package, she had the application ready, and the rest was history. Susie was on a regular package delivery shift in a new neighborhood. Mark was off sick, and Susie needed to cover for him. She had been looking for extra hours anyway. Susie liked this new shift. It was in one of those posh neighborhoods that she barely gets to visit. But besides the packages being more fragile, her job was essentially the same. That was until she pulled up to the last house on the block, and noticeably the biggest and the oldest. When she grabbed the package for the house, it was so heavy. Whatever was in the box was dense, shockingly so. She struggled the box up to the porch and noticed the note that was taped onto the door. It read, "Urgent package. Please bring in and down." All caps. Susie had seen stuff like this before. Her more trusting clients would leave the door unlocked and tell her to leave stuff inside, which made her think back to the thing Todd said about never going into a person's house. Maybe he was just a bad mailman. She went in all the time when people asked her to. But this note didn't just say, "Please bring in." It said, "Please bring in and down." Susie didn't really know what to make of this, and I guess she would see once she got inside. Maybe there were some stairs right near the door or something. Maybe this was standard practice for Mark on his normal shift. She entered the house and was immediately struck by a purely unpleasant smell. It was a mix of fresh cod and some rotting wood, most likely of the pine genus, but you couldn't quite tell what species it was from. Just from the scent, at least. There was an oceanic field recording playing through a small Bluetooth speaker across the room. It was all very confusing. She looked to the other side and saw a small bucket with a fresh cod and some rotting wood. I guess that solves the mystery. She saw and recognized that it was the Monticola species. She should have known that from the scent. She became worried for her forestal identification exam next week, but that was the least of her worries right now. What was the house doing with this California mountain pine in southern Ontario? She looked for a door leading to the basement, but there was nothing in this room. The room left to a long and dark hallway. When she approached it, she noticed a small post-it note on the door, with an arrow on it pointing towards the hallway. It was the same brand of post-it note as the one that was left on the door, the only difference being the color. Susie began to feel scared, but she remembered the postal code that she had signed on to and knew she had to serve the needs of the customer to her utmost capabilities, risking only minor bodily harm. She never knew why she accepted that crazy code. There was some peer pressure involved, but she had never submitted to peer pressure before. Maybe it was from Todd being there. Todd had risked his minor bodily harm when he attempted to outrun that dog when Susie needed her package. She looked down the hallway and noticed that there were 4 doors across each side. Any one of them could contain the much-awaited downward stairs. How long could it take her to check all 8? Maybe 30? 45 seconds? She began to slightly sigh until she noticed a small post-it note on the second last door. She walked over. It said "next door over," pointing to the earlier door. Why wasn't the note just on the correct earlier door? This place was truly full of mysteries. She opened the door and began walking down the steps. As she descended, sounds began to appear. She felt like she had been climbing down for minutes, but when she looked around, it had only been a few steps. She heard what sounded like music, music in the distance. She crept closer, attempting to make it out. It sounded like Billy Idol's Dancing to Myself. Susie couldn't quite tell. She stopped for a second and paid attention to the lyrics. Well, if I looked all over the world, and there's every type of girl, but your empty eyes seem to pass me by and leave me dancing with myself. It was definitely Billy. Oddly poetic. She never thought that about his music before, but it really was. But this only brought more confusion to Susie. Was there a party or something going on? Her more murdery fears were leaving her, but were being replaced by something else. She didn't quite think about it, but she couldn't put a name to it, so she just continued. She wasn't even thinking about how heavy this package was anymore. It was right then when she walked right into the door. She wasn't paying much attention to that. She was paying too much attention to what she was hearing to even think about her other senses. It was then when someone opened the door. Her head was down, and the first thing she could notice were these odd-colored, dorky shoes. As she made her way up the man's body, she noticed an equally dorky button shirt and fingerless gloves. "Oh, hello there," the man mentioned. "That must be for me," he said as he snatched the package right out of Susie's hands. Susie adjusted to what she was seeing and saw that what seemed like an even longer hallway than before. Not this again, she thought. She looked back at the man who was walking away with the package and shouted, "You're going to need to sign for that." He turned around and said, "Well, of course, just come in." The man sat at a table near the long hallway and looked at Susie. She was weary, but knew she really just wanted to sit down, so she joined him. He introduced himself as Jeff. He told her how he was expecting Mark, who knew the drill around here. They liked to play little tricks and try to scare each other. It was all fun, though, he said. Still confused, Susie asked what was going on. What was this place? She looked around. It wasn't much. There was just a bar, a jukebox, and that long, ominous hallway. "Oh, well, it ain't much. But this is my newest venture, my own private bowling alley. Ain't she a beauty?" She looked down the long hallway and noticed some pins way at the end. She noticed that Jeff was actually wearing a full bowling outfit, and she looked at the jukebox and noticed that the only CD was the Bowling Academy's official Greatest Rolling Tracks of the 80s. He opened up the package and pulled out a shiny purple ball and immediately kissed it and gave it a satisfying sniff. He then signed Susie's form and went on and on about his plans for this place. He was going to rent the area out for parties, start his own team, win the national tournament within 6 years. He was confident. Jeff told Susie to grab a drink from the bar, and she graciously grabbed an orange crush and sat back down. She was in no rush. He eagerly shined his new ball and set up his roll. After a few practice swings, he let loose. A strike. Seemed like nothing at all to him. When the ball eventually rolled back, he offered it to Susie. She hadn't bowled since she was a kid. She wasn't even good at it then. When she picked up the ball and looked at the pins, suddenly she knew what to do. She thought of all the occasions of sliding packages down icy walkways when she thought she was going to slip, or precisely throwing dog toys away to distract the local mutts. She thought and she threw the ball. Got 8 out of 10 pins, not bad for a rookie, and that's exactly what Jeff told her. He then asked her if she wanted to be the first draft for his bowling team. "I couldn't possibly. It was beginner's luck. I'm no bowler. I'm just a mailman," she said. Then Jeff looked at her and said, "No, you're a mail woman, and one heck of a bowler." She didn't know why, but when he said that, Susie shed a tear. She quickly wiped it away, and then they began looking for a pair of bowling shoes that would fit her perfectly. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to another episode of Owen's Variety Hour. I hope you had a good time. As always, ignorance of your culture is not considered cool. Now have a good night. Here is Fiona Apple with Daredevil.